Welcome to Wherever You Are. My name is Ryan McNeil in Toronto, Canada, and you're listening to episode 104 of the Matinee Cast. It's the movie-loving podcast of my movie-loving website, thematinee.ca, your home for cinematic passion and perspective. Folks, it's Oscar time again, and last week we arrived at what I believe is the most interesting part of the process, the nomination announcement. You see, it seldom matters who really gets the gold, because Oscar often gets it wrong. The nominees are what fascinates me because from year to year, they form a tapestry of what's happening in film and what's happening in our culture. So to talk about the nominees, we welcome back one of our favorite guests. And besides being the first four-timer on the Matinee Cast, who's not legally married to me, she's a cinephile like few others. She has intelligence and enthusiasm to spare. She has a deep passion for all things old Hollywood and might be the sole reason why I put up freeze frame posts most Thursday. Not to mention the fact that this time we talked to her in her fourth different city, which is impressive in all of its own right. So we're going across a wire tonight to Los Angeles, California, talking to the brains behind the cinema fanatic. Mariah Gates is back. How are you, Mariah?
I'm good. I have to say, technically, I'm in North Hollywood, but I like to say Los Angeles because it sounds more glamorous.
I'll go with it. Like, do you have like rumbles or something? Is it like a turf war thing?
You know, North Hollywood is in the valley.
Oh, okay. See, even I know that has less cred.
But what most people don't realize is most of the studios and post houses and everything are in the valley. So, you know.
Look at that. One quick note about the show. You might have noticed already there's some different music playing underneath, and it will come and go if you're skittish about the music that plays underneath entire episodes. Fear not. The music comes from the nominees for Best Original Score. So you'll hear music composed by John Williams and Alexandre Desplat and Arcade Fire, which I'm super stoked about. For now, though, we're going to go to a new round of knowing the guests. This is Know Your Enemy. Get comfy, folks. This is going to take a second. On Mariah's first appearance, we learned that the first film she'd ever seen in a theater was Willow. The last film she'd seen at the time was Sleuth, the classic version with Olivier and Michael Caine, right?
Yes.
Cool. The worst film she'd ever seen is something called Undiscovered. The unseen classic or essential was Apocalypse Now, and the film she wished she'd made was The Thin Red Line. By the way, she has since seen Apocalypse Now.
Several times. Yes.
it's been that long. Her second appearance, we found out that the film she likes that nobody else does is Center Stage. The film that she dislikes that everybody else digs is Babel. The film to make her cry is now Voyager. In the movie of her life, she would be played by Liz Taylor, and the movie she was watching next was the 1949 version of The Great Gatsby, which I'm sure came in handy this year.
Yes.
And finally, on her third appearance, the film that made her love of movies turn a corner was also The Thin Red Line. The first date movie was Catch Me If You Can. Her sick day movie is Little Women. The last film to leave her speechless was Amour, rightfully so. And her epitaph, well said, was Good Times, Noodle Salad. So here we go. The first time ever, the fourth round of Know Your Enemy questions. Mariah Gates, what is the movie that you really like but you never want to watch again?
This is kind of hilarious because I wrote these out this afternoon and I forgot what last year's answers were because I wrote Amour because I loved it, obviously, and watched it like the day we recorded last year's podcast, and I have not watched it since because it was so traumatic that I don't know if I can handle it. And we played it at the movie theater that I worked at in San Francisco for like 3 months. So I feel like I've watched it many times, but really I just heard, you know, spoiler alert, Emmanuel Riva die like 60 times. And I don't know if I could ever physically watch it again.
See, I think I'd be okay like hearing it because like at the very least it's in French. And while I speak French, I don't speak it well enough to completely follow what's being spoken. And like my brain wouldn't be going full tilt the way it would be if it was a movie in English. Mm-hmm. Like I, it's funny because actually there's a lot of movies that I listen to more than I watch because I listen to movies to fall asleep. So last night I had my eyes closed, but I was listening to 500 Days of Summer and I could fill in, my brain could just fill in what was going on. But at least with Amour, aside from certain moments, I wouldn't necessarily exactly fill in what's going on. But I am amused that from your second appearance to your third and from your third to your fourth, you had these little hinges. That's pretty good. So I can't wait to hear what you answer for my last question and how it'll apply to your fifth appearance. But I'm with you. As much as I adore Amour, I don't know, short of writing about it again or watch or talking about it for a podcast, I can't think of a reason why I would want to revisit it. And it's weird because it's a specific type of heavy, because heavy films don't scare me. But this one, it's like, I guess maybe because it's something that we're all going to go through.
Yeah.
You know, that I don't want to get back to it. Yeah. So no, I can totally get that answer. That's for sure. What is a film that genuinely freaked you out and gave you the heebie-jeebies?
To build up to this one, cut to like 5 years ago, I was living in a little house in my hometown and I couldn't afford it. And I ended up having to move into the back of my parents' house. So it was like a blizzard and I had no heat and it had 2/3 of my house was packed up. And I was in the midst of watching all of David Lynch's filmography. I guess I was starting it because I was doing it in chronological order. So I'm like packing up my house. It's freezing. I'm cold. And I'm watching Eraserhead. It was so weird. And I was so cold. And I don't know if it was so weird because I was so cold or if it's just so weird or a combination. But I was really freaked out after that movie ended. Because, how it has that crazy sound design?
Yeah.
It was like that outside also. And so I'm like, am I living in this movie? What is going on? It was probably the best way to watch Eraserhead for the first time, but.
You were watching it at night too, weren't you?
Yeah. It was not a good decision.
You know, I've actually never seen Eraserhead properly. Like I've seen two or three scenes, but I've never like full on seen it.
It's a weird one.
Well, it's David Lynch, right? So I can only imagine. Did you manage to get some sleep that night or no?
Probably not. I can't remember, but I was cold.
Okay. Okay. I don't mean to traumatize you, so we'll move on. Conversely, what is the film that always makes you laugh?
Okay. This one has made me laugh consistently for like 15 years. Every time I watch it. Is Monty Python and the Holy Grail. So we showed it at one of the other movie theaters that I worked at in San Francisco, and we had these coconuts, and I got paid to tell people that we had a lovely bunch of coconuts. It was the best days of my life. And then I got to watch it, obviously, and it's so funny, and it's funny every time, and the jokes, they never get old. I laugh really hard the whole time. I can recite it.
You know what the funny thing is just for how much that movie is quoted. And I mean, like, you work in an office long enough, you're going to have somebody who quotes Monty Python. If you live in a dorm, you're going to have people who quote Monty Python. If you hang around movie geeks, you're going to have people who quote Monty Python. But for how often it's recited, usually badly, it never gets old.
It really doesn't. It's this timeless, funny from the very beginning with those stupid subtitles.
Yes
it's great. And the DVD with the Henry the Fourth or Henry the Fifth subtitles on it makes it, it's like,
yeah,
it's endless.
Is there a moment that really makes you lose it more than any other?
When he goes, "That rabbit's dynamite." And then it goes
Oh man, no, that's a great, I'm sure that's going to be a few people's answer when I get more and more people onto the fourth show, but definitely a good call. I totally support that. Oh, this ought to be good. What is your favorite movie soundtrack?
I decided after much thought to go with Adventureland.
That's an interesting answer.
currently and for the last since Adventureland came out, so that was what, 4 years, 5 years ago? Oh my God.
Is it that long?
Yeah, it was 2009.
Dear God.
you know, that's how I discovered The Replacements.
Oh, okay.
And they're just so good. And it's every song on that soundtrack is amazing. And it sort of was, I always really loved 80s music, but like the pop, more poppy side. And then that CD really got me into, I think I actually own the CD. It really got me into the like alternative 80s stuff and garage rock. And I have not looked back since.
Yeah. Like I'm looking down the track list and, you know, Lou Reed and The Replacements and David Bowie and, oh gee. And then you've got like
NXS and like, I never knew how great NXS was until I heard that song. And I was like, this is amazing. And then I listened to more NXS and I was like, wow, they're so good. I used to make fun of them.
See, and then you've got the dumb stuff mixed in there as well. Cause there's stuff like there, you know, there's Whitesnake on that soundtrack and Obsession is on that soundtrack. But yeah, no, like lots of really good stuff like Lou Reed and Crowded House and, you know, some good Stones and Jesus and Mary Chain. That's a, like, okay, I gotta be honest. I am deeply, deeply impressed because when my brain goes to the great soundtracks, that's not one that's popping into my mind. That is a great answer. And thank you, because as soon as we're done here, I'm going to be downloading the Adventureland soundtrack.
I listened to that soundtrack nonstop pretty much until 2009.
All right, and the last question, at least for now, is for you to name, and oh, I can only imagine what's coming here, name a movie you like that nobody else has heard of.
Okay, I had a lot, obviously.
Of course you did.
And I was at first I was thinking of going with like a classic, but I've decided instead to go with one from the 80s. I saw this one. It has a really low rating on IMDb. Do not be fooled.
Okay.
It is actually a really funny, interesting film. It is from 1987, and it is called Valley Girls. Not to be confused with Valley Girl. It's a different movie. Valet is in Valet Parking Girls.
Okay.
1987. I don't know if this director has done anything else. I don't think he has.
Okay, I'm just looking at the poster and...
You know, the poster...
And when you say low rating, let's be clear here. This thing is tracking a 3.9 on IMDb.
Just ignore that. I think people didn't get the movie. Like, that makes it look like it's a sexist film, right?
Well, yeah. Tell people what it's about.
Yeah, it's a feminist film, believe it or not. The marketing was clearly not in step with... I don't think they'd actually seen the film. It's about, like, a punk singer who is trying to make it, you know, into rock and roll, but, you know, it's hard. You don't know anybody. So she's working. She moonlights as a valet. The second person is an wannabe actress from like Alabama, and she's really sweet, but she's not very good, so she's also working as this valet thing. And the third one, who is just like, she looks like this bubbly blonde stupid thing, is actually getting her like master's or something in sociology, and she's like undercover to be hit on, basically, and to study the behavior of men.
Okay. And
it's really brilliant. It's a brilliant film.
I am deeply, deeply skeptical. I might see if I can track this thing down. And now, first of all, kudos, because when I said, you know, name something that nobody else has heard of,
I'm pretty sure on I Check Movies, there's like two people who checked it.
Home run, for sure. I'll give this thing 20 minutes. We'll see how it goes. Valet Girls, directed by Rafal Zelinsky. It stars Mary D. Marshall, April Stewart, Mary Conner. I have heard of none of these people.
It's also got some like really good Hollywood satire going on.
I'm sure it does.
And it's great. It's a great film.
All right. We'll see. There we go. That's a lot more about Mariah. I'll think of who knows what for her fifth time around next January. But now it is time to talk about Oscars. So we're going to take a quick break. Come on back right after this. We're going to start with the screenplays. Here's how this is going to work. We're focusing on the major eight categories. So that's writing, acting, directing, and picture. We're basically going to be talking about like the nominees themselves, what we thought about each categories, and kind of go on from there. Before we get into the nominees, Mariah, I meant to ask you, in the major eight categories, there's 12 films scattered across those eight categories. Oh. How many of these 12 have you seen?
I think I've seen all of them.
Oh, well, there we go. Okay, so you've seen them all. The only one I'm short, and by the time this posts, it'll actually be corrected, is As I Sit Here and Speak, I have not yet seen Philomena. But I've seen... Of the majors, I've seen all the others. So starting with adapted screenplay then, we've got Before Midnight, Captain Phillips, Philomena, 12 Years a Slave, and The Wolf of Wall Street.
Of them all, I like 12 Years a Slave probably the best.
Okay.
I really don't understand the Philomena love, to be honest.
Well, to that I can't really speak because I haven't seen it yet. I do know that, I might as well put this in. I know my mom loved it.
Yeah, I'm thinking that's what maybe I'm too bitter of a person. Like, I was watching it and I'm just like, if I were to tell this story, it would have been a much, like, grittier movie. And I feel like Steve Coogan is usually like kind of, I mean, I saw 24-Hour Party People and that was not a happy,
no,
you know, so you would think from Coogan it would be
something more biting.
Yeah. And I'm wondering if somehow it just feels like watered down Coogan. I don't know.
Maybe of everything that came down yesterday morning, it's Friday night as we record this, of everything that came down yesterday morning, Philomena was the surprise for me. Like it definitely was the unexpected winner from the nominations, because I don't think anybody really expected it to do that well. I think like people were talking about it for maybe things like adapted screenplay and certainly for best actress. But mm-hmm. as far as it getting a best picture nomination, that was a little bit of a surprise, but we'll get there. I'm with you as far as Before Midnight goes. Like it was my favorite movie of the year. It says a lot of things and I'm constantly just dumbfounded by how well Julie Delpy, Ethan Hawke, and Richard Linklater were able to take these characters and put them into a new situation. Of all these movies, the one that kind of makes me the most curious is The Wolf of Wall Street.
I guess part of my hesitation with Wolf of Wall Street is I went to a screening of it with Leonardo DiCaprio. Mm. Where he talked afterwards, and he discussed how there was so much improvisation,
yep.
And that there was so much of it that's part of why they had so much footage.
Oh wow!
It kept being different, and it was like he was like in awe of Thelma, you know, being able to cull all these different takes and create a story. Which, if we were talking about editing, I would be like, where's Thelma? But anyway,
yeah. Trust me, I noticed that.
Yeah. But somebody asked him about the screenplay and said, hey, well, how much of what, you know, Terry did, and I think it must have been a friend because she called him Terry, became what we saw on the screen. And Leo kind of dodged the question and went back to talking about improv, you know, the improv that he and Jonah Hill did. And I was just like,
okay.
So I'm like, how much of what was, you know, because the screenplay, they have to turn it in. Like, how much of that
actually made
what he did and how much of it was what the actors did, I don't know. And obviously I love Terrence Winter because the only TV show I watch is Boardwalk Empire. So if he won an Oscar, I'd be like, woo, you know, but I just don't know. Cause it's one of those, like, how much was what he did and how much was what they did and how much is what. And
yeah, you know. No, that is a really, really good question. And you're right. I would now be really, really interested to look at the original screenplay and see, you know, how much of it made it onto the screen. Moving over to the original screenplays, we have American Hustle, Blue Jasmine, Dallas Buyers Club, Her, and Nebraska. Now, for me, this category, the sun rises and sets on Her. Spike Jones has done some really great things in his career already with telling other people's stories. And I didn't really know what to expect with the first time that he was telling his own story. And you and I are both deep, deep fans of Her.
I must point out before we talk about properties from Warner Brothers that I currently work at Warner Brothers, but all of my opinions are based on me and not a reflection of the company.
Gotcha. I'll make sure that I put that into my notes as well.
Yeah. That's part of the like
the disclaimer. Yep.
Yeah. No,
and you know, those things need to be taken seriously.
I really loved her. I've seen it twice already.
I mentioned this on somebody else's podcast this weekend, and that show is probably going to be going up very, very soon. Her really, really, really could have been the Siri movie. Like on a surface level, just the same way that The Social Network is described as the Facebook movie, mm-hmm. her really could have just been the Siri movie. And the fact that it's not, and that nobody's referring to it that way, such a reflection of Spike Jonze's work in this screenplay.
I think because he's made films for so long, and films that were written by really great writers.
Yep.
That he had a really, you know, and then he's taken those and made these beautiful films. So he understands storytelling to the core. And then, you know, he's been in the industry for so long that he's made these great friends and he talked to the right people. And I, as a screenwriter myself, I know that is invaluable, being able to share your ideas with people who can springboard with you to make it just that much better.
Right.
And I think he surrounded himself with the right people to get what he had out of him in such a beautiful way.
Well, speaking of that, he has a really good working relationship with David O. Russell, which came from when Spike acted in Three Kings back in 99. Yeah. And David O. Russell, he gave him a lot of notes on her. And I think, if I understand this correct, Spike gave him notes on American Hustle. And here they are both nominated in the same category. I don't actually know the answer to this. Where do you come down on American Hustle? Because it really started to seem like a love it or hate it kind of movie.
I kind of hated it.
Really?
Halfway through it, I was really bored and I wanted it to be done.
Oh, Lord.
And that doesn't happen that often. Usually I get really sucked into movies and they go, like, I watched The Great Beauty. Mm-hmm. That thing is like 3 hours and I didn't even know the time passed and it was over. And, you know, but because I was really sucked in. But with American Hustle, it felt tedious.
Okay. I dug it. It's a movie, I say I like it a lot. I think it's timely. Like, I really think that what's been happening in North America over the last 4 or 5 years, that I don't think it's a shock that films like American Hustle and The Wolf of Wall Street and Spring Breakers and Pain and Gain and The Bling Ring, that they are all coming now, because, you know, it's really, really indicative of the times that we're living in. So American Hustle, while it may not be perfect, like, for me, that's a good story. This is a good round of screenplays.
Really loved Nebraska. It went places I was not expecting, which I like in a screenplay.
Me too.
Specifically with the June Squibb character.
Yeah.
She starts out what you think she's one thing. And I was a little offended by her as a character at first, because I was at the screenwriter really for creating, you know, for painting her the way she was at the beginning.
Yep.
And then the more you see her, the more you see who she really is. And I was like, whoa, this is one of the best like peeling of layers of a character that I've like maybe ever seen. And part of it is clearly the screenplay, and part of it is June Squibb's amazing performance.
You got it. You're speaking my language, because it's another one of my favorite movies of the year.
It's a beautiful film.
Yeah. We will be talking more about it, because there's some actors nominated. So come on back after this break and we'll get into the 4 acting categories right after this. So for Best Supporting Actress, we have Sally Hawkins for Blue Jasmine, Jennifer Lawrence for American Hustle, Lupita Nyong'o for 12 Years a Slave, Julia Roberts for August, Osage County, and June Squibb for Nebraska. So some real talent in this category for damn sure.
Yeah, I was most excited to see Sally Hawkins get in, because I still feel the pain of her happy-go-lucky snub.
Yep.
Like, hardcore, like, she was so good in that, and she was so good in Blue Jasmine. And so I'm just, if there was any sort of like crazy unexpected win, if it was her, I would not be upset.
Yeah, I'm definitely with you, except for me, if there's any justice in the world, when we get to the end of Oscar night, Lupita Nyong'o will be holding a statue. She, as a person and as an actress, is just coming into this whole thing with so much poise and so much grace and so much gratitude for where she is, mm-hmm. that you can't help but just want nothing but great things for her. You know, I got to see this the week it premiered. I got to see it at TIFF, mm-hmm. and you know, so first of all, I'm seeing a woman on stage and on screen, like she came out and talked to the audience afterwards, who none of us had ever heard of before. Like this is her first role. The prior to this, she was working like crew for, I think, The Constant Gardener is the only other credit she's got. So first of all, for her to do it basically as her first dive into the pool is one thing. And second of all, this is a movie with some fantastic female performances. There's three to speak of, really, and all three of them are so complicated. So for her to really, really run with it in the face of veterans like Alfre Woodard and Sarah Paulson, it is phenomenal, and just I wholeheartedly want nothing but the best for her.
She went to Yale, right?
I think so.
Like, yeah, that's where isn't that where Meryl Streep went? That's where all the best, they, you know, go to Yale, come out. Phenomenal. I always wanted to go to Yale. That's why
I was going to say, you went to school on the wrong coast.
I know. I actually started the Yale application and it was really hard.
There's always time. You're still very young. There's always time. June Squibb, we just talked about a moment ago.
And I'm really happy to see Julia Roberts like be so great. I love her. I've always loved her. All of her movies. I think she's great. I'm glad she's not, you know, America's sweetheart anymore. And she just plays these like real, these women who feel really real.
Yeah. The thing I'd kind of like, well, first of all, Julia Roberts is now in a place where she works when she wants to.
Yeah.
You know, she's got more money than God. She's got an Oscar. She's happy. She's married. She's got kids. She is absolutely at this point living life the way it's supposed to be lived, where she basically works when she wants to. The only thing, if I were to ever say, hey, Julia, would you mind doing this? I'd love to see her start not playing Julia Roberts. I'd love to see her try something just a little more difficult. And then, of course, we get to Jennifer Lawrence, which, like, if there's any actor who's on a better run than Jennifer Lawrence, I'm hard-pressed to think of them, besides being in one of the biggest franchises in Hollywood right now and in the biggest moneymaker of the last year, which is an impressive in its own right. Here's a woman who at 23 is already a 3-time Oscar nominee and a winner.
Yeah, I was trying to think. I think she's beat Kate Winslet's
standing for like.
Yeah, because Kate was like the youngest to have 3 and then she was the youngest to have 4. And I'm pretty sure the J-Law totally.
I don't think Kate was doing it at 23. There's, you know, we're not really going to get too far into predictions, but it's entirely possible that Jennifer Lawrence wins. Did you know you were saying that you were kind of middling on American Hustle?
I really didn't like her in this.
Really?
I actually didn't like her in Silver Linings either.
Okay.
So, actually, the only film that I liked her in was Winter's Bone.
Okay. Man, Tumblr must drive you nuts.
I know. There's so much Jennifer Lawrence everywhere. I'm just like,
So, over to Best Supporting Actor, we've got Barkhad Abdi for Captain Phillips, Bradley Cooper in American Hustle, Michael Fassbender in 12 Years a Slave, Jonah Hill, try saying 2-time Oscar nominee Jonah Hill without smirking.
I tweeted it.
Oh, boy. For The Wolf of Wall Street and Jared Leto for Dallas Buyers Club.
I'm just really excited for Jonah Hill. I don't care if people don't like him. He loves what he does. He worked hard to do the things that he wanted to do. And he's done really interesting work in a variety of types of films. And I think he's one of the like freshest like male voices in Hollywood, because a lot of the men tend to do the same shit over and over, and they get stuck. Especially, you know, I think maybe it's because he doesn't look like your typical like Hollywood, you know,
nope,
Barbie or whatever. Nope. So he's been able to like do all kinds of things. Because he has like a character actor's body, basically.
Right.
He's gotten to have a really interesting career. And I haven't seen all of his movies, obviously, but everything that I've seen him in, I've liked him in. So I'm just really happy for him.
You know what I'm starting to think? What he could be, and I don't just mean it because who I'm going to bring up is heavy. He could be a really young John Goodman.
Yeah.
You know how Goodman can do a lot of different things?
Yeah.
I really think that if Hill's going to model himself, like, hell, I would love to see Jonah Hill go do a Coen Brothers movie.
Oh, my God. He would be amazing.
Of course. Here's... Back to my point about Julia Roberts, here's a guy who, when he doesn't play Jonah Hill, and when I say Jonah Hill, I mean the guy who hangs out with Seth Rogen and Jay Baruchel, yeah. This is when he does interesting stuff. Fassbender is capital E evil in 12 Years a Slave.
And I'm so happy that he's finally an Oscar nominee.
Yes, like, this should make a lot of people very, very happy.
This is like the greatest. He's just such a good actor. And obviously he... graces my Tumblr a lot.
This is going to turn into a drinking game very quickly. Kind of like Lupita Nyong'o, super, super excited for Barkhad Abdi.
Oh, yeah. He was a driver, he was, you know, an actor who was driving because he couldn't get work. And then suddenly, boom.
He gets work. And it's like the only thing is I kind of hope that this isn't the last I've heard from him. It kind of strikes me as a sort of role where it's a one off and I don't hear from him ever again. And I really hope that's not the case.
Well, you know, I'm hoping he can do like Damon Hunsu, who went on, he came out with Amistad and then he had a pretty solid. He's had a pretty solid career since, you know.
Still does. He turns up every once in a while.
Yeah, he was in one of the worst movies I saw this year, but he was pretty good in it. I think there's opportunities.
I hope so.
If you can get the right projects.
Yeah, that's the thing. I think it's going to come down to casting. Bradley Cooper is around. Bradley Cooper, he's pretty much doing his Bradley Cooper thing.
Yeah.
And then Jared Leto, who's doing certainly something different for him. I loved it, but the thing is, it's kind of showy what he does in Dallas Buyers Club.
Yeah, it is, and I haven't heard great things from the community from which he's representing.
Yeah, they're pissed.
Like... especially post, you know, now that he's riding the like acclaim wave,
right.
He hasn't really represented well, I think.
No, it could be the kind of thing that he, you know, his chances might have peaked too early. I still really liked it. Like for Leto has always struck me as a guy who's a bit of a dick.
Yeah.
So, and I've got no basis on that. I've never met the guy, but just his persona. It's probably because I don't like his music, which of course has everything to do with his acting. But this role and not, you know, not to kind of put any kind of stereotypes or anything like that, but it really seemed to humanize him. Like it really took away that dickishness. And that was what I was drawn to. Not so much that, you know, that he misrepresented or that he turned it into sort of a caricature, which he kind of did. And it is, you're right. It's possible that all might work against him and that we might be hearing somebody else's name. But
no, I also this is not to poo-poo Jared Leto, but I feel the need to bring this up.
Sure.
That it would have been nice, maybe casting wise, to actually, I don't know, hire a trans actress to play a trans character.
Yep.
You know, like I was thinking just this morning about The Crying Game and how they, spoiler alert, they actually cast somebody for the role of Dill who was the right orientation. It couldn't be too hard to go out there and find somebody.
No. And considering...
but then you want a name, and so there aren't any, you know, celebrity trans women yet. And I emphasize yet because there will be and there should be.
I'm sure.
You know, we're not there yet.
Right. And considering what we've already said about, you know, the performances garnered out of Lupita Nyong'o and Barkhad Abdi, it's like sometimes, you know, you get somebody who's not a name and you get something really, really special out of them.
Exactly. So. And especially if you had like Matthew McConaughey, he's money in the bank. You can take a risk on some of your supporting characters.
Yep. Totally. But. Over in Best Actress, we have Amy Adams in American Hustle, Kate Blanchett in Blue Jasmine, Sandra Bullock in Gravity, Judi Dench in Philomena, and Meryl Streep in August, Osage County. I had 4 out of 5 of these pegged. This was a category which had kind of been trending very much the same in the run up, and the one little last minute switch that I saw it coming, I just didn't call it. Was Amy Adams in and Emma Thompson out. Don't get me wrong, she didn't do anything particularly special in American Hustle that she hasn't done, you know, in The Master and in Junebug and that kind of thing, but I sort of kind of feel like it's her time, especially because all the other women have statues.
Yeah. Yeah, she's the only one who hasn't won, and she's, like, this is her 5th nomination. Yeah. Like, this is, we're getting to ridiculousness at this point.
Yes. However, she's up against Kate Blanchett, and for me, this whole category just kind of rises and sets on the beautiful mess that she turned Jasmine into in this movie.
Yeah, I really was a fan of that performance. I specifically liked the very last scene. A lot of times the last scene is what stays with you the longest. And for me, that really was the case with Blue Jasmine. And not just because I'd been in that park many times, but there was just something about her realization right when you realize it, that everywhere that she's at, she got herself there.
Yeah.
And that just made it even more of a tragedy, sort of.
You know, I asked you earlier a film that you like that you don't want to watch again, and one of my friends, Andrew Robinson, was talking about Blue Jasmine in that respect this week, about how affected he was by the film, but how uncomfortable it made him feel, and really, Kate Blanchett is a big, big part of that. She plays... She's somebody who you feel so terrible for. Like, on the one hand, if you started talking to her at a party, you would walk away. But at the same time, you'd feel so bad about it. I kind of feel like Sandra Bullock isn't getting enough credit for Gravity, which sounds so strange to say because it's her show. But of everything that's being talked about in Gravity, she's kind of the least, she's kind of getting the least credit.
I would agree. There's a lot of attention played on Karan's direction and obviously the 3D, but you know, you're going to see the movie for the character, for the performance, for the person. And she really makes you connect with that character.
Who was supposed to play that character originally? Do you remember?
It went through a bunch of casting. Like, there was Natalie Portman was attached for a while. And they were trying to get Carey Mulligan. And because it was right after An Education. Oh, and man. Then at one point it was, I feel like at one point it was Angelina Jolie and Robert Downey Jr. And then Angelina Jolie left, so Robert Downey Jr. left. And then finally they wound up with Sandra Bullock, and then George was like, oh, I'll do it. And, you know.
And it's funny because here's the thing. Like, here's how big of a difference that Bullock makes, is that you put any of those other women in the part and it turns into such a different movie.
It would be, you know, like I was looking at the Critics' Choice list yesterday. I didn't actually watch the show. And they had a category called Best Actress in an Action Film, and they had Sandra Bullock in that list, and I was like, Gravity was an action film? And if you had Angelina Jolie in it, yeah, it probably would have wound up being an action film, because that's sort of what she does. But with Sandra Bullock, it became more of a human drama.
Yeah.
Than, you know, with occasional, you know, fire sequences, but
yeah, it's you know, she sells it. You're right. The story behind it has really, really been short sold. You know, right down to the fact that it didn't get a screenplay nomination, which I think is really kind of a shame, actually, because I think there's actually a lot of things going on in the story of Gravity. But she is what sells that. She is what makes this movie more than just a technical exercise. You know, and don't get me wrong, she's not completely just playing off herself. It's not 127 hours. But she's carrying the weight of this movie. As I mentioned before, I have not seen Philomena, so I'm going to kind of skirt past Judi Dench. And Meryl Streep, holy crap, she just destroys everybody in her way in August Osage County. You know, if she hadn't just been rewarded for a much lesser part, I'd be singing a different tune.
Yeah.
But I think she needs to sit on the bench for a little while. Over with the boys, we have Christian Bale for American Hustle, Bruce Dern for Nebraska, Leonardo DiCaprio for The Wolf of Wall Street. That made a lot of people online very happy. Chiwetel Ejiofor for 12 Years a Slave, and Matthew McConaughey for The Dallas Buyers Club.
I was really excited by the Leonardo DiCaprio nomination. I actually didn't have that predicted because I felt like his, a lot of the wave of the campaign happened after voting.
Yes.
Went down. So I was like, I was pretty sure. And I heard, you know, now that I live in Los Angeles, I hear things.
That's why I have you on.
I know. So I heard about an Academy screening where Academy members, though they were the older Academy members, but they were Academy members, turned to Scorsese after it was over and said, "Shame on you." And these are like the voters, right? Yeah. So they're angry. So I was assuming that perhaps that anger would continue. But I guess the younger viewers or the, I don't know, the less stodgy, I don't know.
Yeah, no, you got it.
Voters were like, could really see what they were doing and that they weren't, you know, making a movie that put this guy on a pedestal. And if you saw that, and if you thought that that's what they were doing, then you missed the point of the movie.
Yeah. This was a category where there were, slight surprises, not jaw-dropping shocks, but slight surprises. And it's only because this was a category that kind of seemed to be almost set in stone all autumn long with McConaughey, Ejiofor, and Dern, along with Tom Hanks for Captain Phillips and Robert Redford for All Is Lost, especially because Redford hadn't been nominated before.
That's what I had predicted.
Yeah.
The only reason I watched All Is Lost was because I thought he was going to get a nomination. No offense, Redford, but I just really didn't want to see an old man on a boat for an hour and a half.
But wait a minute. Did you like it?
I liked the music, and then it didn't get nominated.
That's the thing, actually. I really like that as a movie. Like, beyond just a performance, I actually really, really like that as a film. I came away with, like, even though I think I ranked them the same when I wrote about them, that was a really, really affectionate 3.5 stars out of 4, whereas American Hustle was like that's a 3.5. You know what I mean? Christian Bale, oh, man, like...
actually the only thing in the movie that I liked.
Right.
So I really didn't like any of the other performances. I kind of liked Renner. I liked what they did together, Bale and Renner.
Yes.
I thought they had a really good, they really felt like buddies.
Yeah. Now here's the funny thing with Bale. He's kind of the anti-Julia Roberts, where I don't know what else he can do. I've seen him get big. I've seen him get skinny. I've seen him go crazy. I've seen him do Heroes. I don't know, like, I don't know what the man can do anymore. Like, short of seeing him in a plucky romantic comedy opposite Katherine Heigl, I don't know what he can do to surprise me anymore.
Yeah.
So, you know, and that sounds like a knock, and it kind of is, but it's what the guy has done with the last 15 years of his career. So, you know, like, he needs to do, like, Robert McKee and just start giving seminars, you know?
He could do like Ralph Fiennes did and be in a romantic comedy with Jennifer Lopez.
Right. Yeah. There we go. Perfect.
And smile a little bit.
Yep. Bruce Dern is amazing in Nebraska. And Bruce Dern is an icon. He's kind of doing the Lifetime Achievement Award in this category. And if he were to take home the gold, it would be totally deserved, not just for Nebraska, because I think he is really clever as Woody Grant, but also just for what he's done with his career.
Mm-hmm.
And then if I had a vote, it would be for Chiwetel Ejiofor.
Yes. Agreed.
Because he just destroys us in 12 Years a Slave. Like he
and so much of it is just his face.
Yep.
It's like he goes through so many stages of grief and denial and like resurgence and all these things, and it's not with the dialogue, it's all in his damn face. I don't even know.
He looked like, quite literally, he looks right at us, and it brings on so many emotions when he does. Like, the film starts with him and a group of slaves looking right to camera, and one of the last shots of the film is him looking just off camera. You know, he brings it all out in you, and he just like lets you sit and let these emotions wash through you, and he puts so much on his face. If nothing, like, he is finally getting the respect that he deserves. He's been working at this for a long time.
Yeah, and he's an actor who can do any kind of film. Like, he's great in Children of Men. He was phenomenal. And then you had him in, to bring Angelina Jolie back into things because I love her, Salt.
Oh, yeah, that's right. He was
so
in Salt.
Good in Salt.
Like, now we gotta represent here, because when I think about Chiwetel Ejiofor, my brain goes to Kinky Boots.
Believe it or not, I still haven't seen.
Oh, honey, you're in for a treat.
I know. You're, and I'm like, how have I not seen this movie? Yeah,
you must see Kinky Boots.
Not on Netflix, that's why.
Yeah, that's the reason. We're gonna talk about McConaughey at length in a few minutes, like right now, if you're betting big, I'd say bet on McConaughey. Did you watch True Detective?
No, I haven't had a chance to yet. I forgot that it already started.
Yeah, if you do, like, it's really, really good. And the only thing I kind of worry about with True Detective is just that it's not going to go on for very long, because I'm like, where are these guys going to find the time to do this, because they're both such busy actors. But he's amazing in True Detective. We're going to talk about him in the final section. But yeah,
if anything, I'd like to see him kind of win, so that the stupid internet Leonardo DiCaprio never wins an Oscar meme will go away.
Yeah,
because it was old like 3 years ago, and it's driving me nuts. And a lot of them are people who don't know like Academy history, so like, he's not the most shafted actor ever. Okay,
not even close.
We just lost the most shafted actor of all time, and he's never gonna win now because he died.
Yeah.
So, and Leo is like 36.
Yeah.
37.
He's a spring chicken.
He's got a long time to go.
Yeah.
But also, he was really phenomenal in Wolf of Wall Street. So
he was, and you know what? When it comes down to it, for me, it's just, any other year, I'd be saying absolutely. But the fact of the matter is, if I'm looking down this category, I've got him and I have a vote. I've got him fourth down on the depth chart. I've got Dern, Ejiofor, and McConaughey above him in some particular order that I can't settle on, just because of what each one of them do and how much more each one of them means to their movie. Like, don't get me wrong, Leo does some awesome things, but at the end of the day, he's still in the hands of Marty Scorsese, and he is, you know, he's had five movies now to bring this out of him. Don't get me wrong, he's deserving, and if he wins, it would be a great thing, and again, it would be very, very well deserved. But for me, at least these other three did something just a little bit more special than Leo does, and Leo will have lots of other chances. But we'll talk about that again in a second, because there's a lot more Wolf of Wall Street to discuss in Best Director and Best Picture coming up right after this. Best Director, we have Alfonso Cuarón for Gravity, Steve McQueen for 12 Years a Slave, Alexander Payne for Nebraska, David O. Russell in American Hustle, that's fun to say, and Martin Scorsese in The Wolf of Wall Street. No surprises.
Yeah, I actually had, I actually had Dallas Buyers Club over Scorsese in my...
Oh, you had Jean-Marc Vallée. Look at you go.
I had him there because I thought that's where it was going. But I'm really happy to see Alfonso Cuarón get this, because he should have been nominated for Children of Men. And I will never not believe that he got snubbed for that, because you see Children of Men. So I love him so much, and I've loved him for a long time. And I kind of almost think he might win it.
I think that's very possible, actually.
This movie is such... I mean, we were just talking about Sandra Bullock, but it's Sandra Bullock and him, and that's it.
Yes.
That's the movie.
Yeah.
So I can see that really happening.
Well, it's funny that you mention his work in Children of Men, because if we were to dial back the clock to 2006, that really should have been the year that we should have seen the Three Amigos all jockeying for Best Director, because that was the year that Cuarón did Children of Men. Iñárritu did Babel, and Guillermo del Toro did Pan's Labyrinth. Steve McQueen, if you had told me after Shame that Steve McQueen would be an Oscar-nominated director on his next project, I might have said you were crazy. Not just because of the kinds of films he was making, because they really weren't the kind of films that the Academy likes, but because he's a bit of a dick.
Yeah.
Now, with 12 Years a Slave, I don't know if he's just had an attitude change or if he's just really, really proud of what he's done, but he's representing himself and the project better. And I really think that that's paid big dividends for him. In an ideal world, he would take this category, but he's in really, really tough against Cuarón.
Yeah, I think that's his main... I think it's going to be a duel between the two of them. Like, the other three have all been nominated multiple times. Scorsese finally won.
Yep.
And, you know, both of them are having their first time, and they have the two highest profile films pretty much.
Yep.
And I could see it either going together or doing a split where one of them gets director and one of them gets picture. I could really see that happening. I don't know which, though. Like, it could flip-flop either way.
Yep.
Really. I do want to point out, though, that this is only the second time that a Best Picture has been directed by a person of color.
That's right.
And that's really a sad statistic.
Yes, it is.
But also an important one, and something that should be pointed out, I think. And I also think part of what makes 12 Years a Slave work is McQueen's take on it, because he's not American.
Yeah.
So he's able, kind of like what von Trier does, except that von Trier doesn't actually get America because he's never been here, and he has like his own von Trier idea of America based on television or something.
Yeah.
But McQueen has been here, and he's seen the culture that we live in the wake of what we were founded on, which is slavery, which we try to ignore, and we still try to ignore. And we're always going to ignore, because that's how America works. We try to ignore the things that we did that were messed up.
Before you leave the point, I must also underline that Canada is not a whole lot better. It's actually kind of a crazy thing in 12 Years a Slave. In the last act, you got Brad Pitt saying, "I'm from Canada. Do you know where that's from?" And it's like, guys, there was slavery in Canada too. It wasn't as prevalent, but it happened. And to just, you know, to try and play Canada as the beacon of hope is not exactly true. Don't get me wrong. Yeah. It was certainly a lot better. And it wasn't driving our economic engine. But it's the same sort of, like, you know, Canada's done terrible things with the natives. Canada did terrible things with Asians in World War II. And, you know, yep, there was slavery here too. And we do try to forget about all this.
We really do. And, like, we put it in the little boxes in our textbooks. And I think McQueen was able to really shine a really beautiful lit light on our ugly past.
Yeah.
And make us see things that we really try to ignore. And you know, like, the next highest profile movie we have really about slavery is Django. And what does that say about America? I'm not really sure.
Yeah.
You know, it was really hard to watch it in a theater. I saw it in a really packed theater.
Yep.
And this woman a few seats down from me was pretty much going through, like, the stages of
grief.
Like, vocally, like, white guilt grief.
Oh, no.
It's like she really, I mean, I don't know who she was, but it felt like someone who really didn't know how horrible slavery really was.
Yeah.
And was seeing it for the first time, and she couldn't even keep it in.
again, in lesser hands, this movie would just be like kind of like we were saying with Her is the Siri movie. In lesser hands, this movie would be Slavery is Bad. And it's really not. Like, it's something that just hangs on to you with two hands. And like we were saying with Edgeofor's performance, it looks right at you and it dares you to look away. And that really, really comes down to what Steve McQueen did with the direction of the movie. The other three guys, they're kind of all in the same circle, just because I really think they're all just kind of afterthoughts in this category, just because Cuaron and McQueen did such amazing things. Mm-hmm. But we've got Alexander Payne again. He's on a bit of a run because he was nominated previously with the Descendants, and he's on a great little streak, really.
Really nice guy, from what I hear, too.
Yeah, I got to see him do a presentation of Nebraska at the Lightbox here in Toronto, and he was in love with the fact that he was able to do a black and white movie, because he said so many of his favorite movies are in black and white. I'm going to skip past David O. Russell for now, because we're going to talk about him in a minute. Martin Scorsese, what the hell can you say? In any other year, he would be taking home his second Oscar. I feel like he's too overmatched. I think it was my brother pointed out to me that look at the last 10 years of Scorsese films and find a 10-year stretch of his career that's better than this. And that's really saying something.
He is a master.
Yes.
You know, he knows the craft. He knows the history. He knows everything about what he's doing. He's one of the few, he's like Ennio Morricone, you know. He is a master at what he does, and everything he's going to do from here on out is going to be at a level that most people won't ever reach.
Like, he's so good, he's an adjective.
Yeah.
You know? In a way, I'm kind of impressed with, first of all, I'm always impressed with his working relationship with his team. You know, like he works with Robbie Robertson on almost every one of his films. He works with Thelma Schumacher on almost every one of his films. You know, he's been working with Terrence Winter now between this movie and Boardwalk Empire, you know, that he does for TV. And he's like, I can only imagine that he's got this verbal shorthand with all of them. Like, this is a guy who speaks a mile a minute, but I imagine that he's able to communicate with all these so well and see eye to eye. Moving on to Best Picture, we have 9 nominees again. American Hustle, Captain Phillips, Dallas Buyers Club, Gravity, Her, Nebraska, Philomena, 12 Years a Slave, and The Wolf of Wall Street. So tell me a little bit about Philomena, and like, is this a worthy inclusion? Because
I just honestly don't think so. Okay. I thought it was like a nice, I do a 5-star scale usually.
Yep.
And it was like a run of the mill, like 3-star, you know, the thing is, it's Stephen Frears, and he's somebody who I think was great in like 20 years ago and has like regressed.
Okay.
Because didn't he also do The Queen?
Yeah.
I really did not like The Queen.
Really?
Either.
Okay, I like The Queen.
It was overwrought. If we're going to have like an old person, an old lady role, you know, and she sounds like she's an interesting person, but what came out in the movie for me was just like, this is really the most interesting character you could make a movie about.
Yeah. See, it's funny because, you know, we talked about like what we predicted. Best Picture, I had 8 of these 9 figured by the time we got to the week before the nominations. And if anybody doesn't believe me, go and look at my last Oscar predictions post, because I said there's these 4 that are locked, these 4 that are pretty sure, and then there's one more. I don't know what it's going to be. But I did not, Philomena wasn't even on my radar. I thought it was going to be something like Blue Jasmine or Inside Llewyn Davis or Saving Mr. Banks or, you know, like, or Before Midnight if I was getting really, really lucky. But Philomena certainly wasn't the 9th one that I saw coming. I will be seeing it soon, so I can kind of get my stamp on it. And probably by the time this posts, there'll be a review. So for all I know, the movie just like rings the right note with me. But I always do sit down to these films wanting to enjoy them, so I'm not, you know, going into it begrudgingly. her, we haven't talked about a whole lot. We talked about it back with screenplay. In an ideal world, it would get a win, but I really think that its Best Picture nomination is its win.
Yeah.
Ditto, Dallas Buyers Club, same thing. Its nomination here is its win. Its nomination here is actually its big win because it's a movie that, as the autumn went on, really picked up momentum and did well to land itself a Best Picture nomination. Captain Phillips is a different story. Captain Phillips,
I really did not like that movie.
Really?
I really don't like Paul Greengrass.
Okay. Yeah, then you were screwed for starters.
I don't understand why this movie is like, I don't see what people see in it. I don't get it.
You know what it is? It's a movie that's third act is fantastic. Going back to that, you know, that reference to McKee, you know, he always says, wow them in the third act and you've got a hit. And that's what Captain Phillips did. From the moment those Navy SEALs show up, everybody in that audience is on board. Well, anybody who's not named Mariah Gates,
yeah,
is on board. And that's what really drove.
You know, what I was thinking while I was watching it was that, and this is kind of how I felt about the other Greengrass that I've seen, is that I feel like he's a big fan of showing you how something happened.
Sure.
And this is because he, you know, he comes from documentary and his style is sort of quasi-documentary. But he shows you the hows, and he's really good at showing you the hows. But I don't think he ever really delves into the, like, why.
No, I don't think he's – I don't know that he's interested.
And I know, and that's part of why I'm not interested in him.
Oh.
Because I actually would rather have gone into the why of it all. I would have been more interested in, like, the day leading up to the taking of it from the Somali pirates' point of view. Like, that would have been a more interesting story to me. Like, investigating why he ended up being where he was, where this is, you know, because there's one line in the movie that I liked where Captain Phillips says, you know, there's got to be more to life than pirating and maybe in America.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, that would have been an interesting story. Show me why that he answered that.
Yeah.
I would have enjoyed that movie.
Exactly.
But it's not the movie they were making, so.
No. Nebraska, I'm pleased this punch that it got nominated, but its night is done.
Yeah.
And then you like this is really if there's four films that stand a chance and one of them doesn't really stand a chance to take the gold, it's Wolf of Wall Street, 12 Years a Slave, American Hustle, and Gravity. American Hustle really surprises me because if there's a movie that is peaking at the right time, Lordy, is it American Hustle.
Yeah.
Which, you know, and and that's there. Like, there's your answer right there with you know. We're going to talk about a few more and give predictions later, but we've really kind of gone on quite a bit about 12 Years a Slave, Wolf of Wall Street, and Gravity. So I'm going to skip those for now. But come on back after this. We're going to talk about some trends and such before we close out the show after this break. Of course, if, you know, no conversation about award nominations would be complete without talk of omissions. Were there any that really surprised you more than any others?
Well, the one that surprised me, and I don't necessarily think he deserved a nomination, but I thought he was going to get it, was Daniel Brühl in Rush.
Oh, yeah, okay.
You know, because he had the Golden Globe and the SAG and several critic nominations, and... You know, that's actually the only reason I saw the movie was I wasn't going to see the movie because it was like, ugh, race cars. And then I saw a trailer and he was in it and I was like, oh, I should see this. And then I didn't. And then when he got the Golden Globe and the SAG nom, I was like, oh my God, is he going to get an Oscar nomination? I love him. And so I watched it and he's good because he's always good. But I didn't think he was like that. I didn't think he was that great. But okay. I thought that's where the, like, momentum was going. And then I feel like he probably was one of the guys that woke up, you know, because all his people were telling him to wake up and see his nomination. And so that was sort of strange. And then obviously the big, like, you know, complete shutout was Llewellyn Davies, like Davis, other than cinematography.
Now, here's the thing. So inside Llewellyn Davies, that same post where I said, you know, if you want to figure out where I said 8 of 9, go back to this post. I might even just put it in the show notes. So look in the show notes for my Oscar prediction post. I mentioned that Llewellyn Davies was trending badly, and specifically it was that the Writers Guild, the Producers Guild, and the Directors Guild weighed in the weeks, like they nominated their own awards in the weeks leading up to the Oscar nominations, and none of them went for the Coen brothers. And usually the Coen brothers, they're industry darlings. Everybody who looks on their work just does so with such reverence and awe that even sometimes when it looks like something is not going their way, I'm thinking of something like True Grit, you get to Oscar morning and it shows up with a whole boatload of nominations.
Yeah.
But the thing is that as much as I adore Inside Llewellyn Davies for a lot of the things it does, it leaves people so damn cold.
Oh, I know. I saw it at the I sound like a Hollywood asshole right now, but I saw it at the Directors Guild. And
awesome.
I know people, okay. And it was full of Directors Guild people, and there was a Q&A.
Yeah.
And they were a little rough in their Q&A, actually.
Oh.
Yeah, they were a little like, they were kind of like the character in the movie.
Oh, okay.
And Sam Raimi was the Q&A guy, and he was like really trying to, you know, get them in it. But then when the movie was over, I was listening, and the Q&A was over and people were chattering, and I was like listening because it was a lot of DGA people, and I was like, I want to hear the chatter. There was a lot of, about it, because it's a movie with a character who's just not that sunny.
it's not just that he's not that sunny, but it's that he's so damned uncompromising. You know,
yeah.
And that's the thing. It's like if he were to just bend just a little bit, you might go with him a little bit more. But he spends the movie so sour.
And I think that caused a lot of people to just not really enjoy the film because they couldn't
latch on
really to the character. I've had the opposite. I really loved this character. You reminded me of me. tells you a lot about me.
A little bit, yeah. It did not strike me as a surprise. This is a movie that is a critical darling and has a particular audience, but it is not the movie that speaks to a group like the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. Mm-hmm. For me, you know, it seems strange to say this just because it wasn't really tracking, but I kind of thought that it might have got a little bit more love as the year went on. And kind of would have played into certain things, but I was sort of surprised that we got to the end of the morning and there was not one damn thing for Fruitvale Station.
Yeah. I really thought it was going to at least get a screenplay.
That was what I thought. Like I kind of thought that it might, like, you know, in the age of 9 nominations, there seems to now be more and more space for these indie films. Like, and I mean capital I indie films. I'm not talking about like Nebraska indie. I'm talking like Beasts of the Southern Wild or An Education indie, or The Kids Are All Right. And so that was kind of where I thought there would be some space at the table for a film like Fruitvale Station or Michael B. Jordan in it, or certainly Octavia Spencer in it.
Yeah.
But nada.
I think, regardless though, it served as a really nice launching pad for Michael B. Jordan.
Oh, sure.
And I think we'll see him at the Oscars, you know, within a decade.
Yeah,
if he keeps choosing wisely.
Yes. And the film's director, Ryan Coogler, I believe it was his debut.
It was his writing
and directing debut. So
debut.
You know, great start, dude. But, you know, for what I'm saying is, for how much we're jumping up and down about 12 Years a Slave, it was a pretty big year in film for Black cinema, and it kind of all got ignored.
Yeah. Because there was that, and there was
There's Mandela, and there's Mandela. The Butler.
Yeah, I actually had The Butler as one of my picks. I really thought it might make its way in.
Oh, yeah.
I hadn't seen it till about a week ago. I was, catching up on some things. And I expected a lot more than I was expecting to.
Yeah.
It was a little like cliff notes-y, which I saw a lot of people complaining about that. But a lot of the thing about cliff notes that people forget is that nobody wants to read the damn novel. I do. Yeah. But your average person doesn't. Yeah. They want to read the cliff notes. And at least if they've read the cliff notes and it's done well,
yeah,
they have a better understanding of a part of that novel that they wouldn't have had prior to it, right?
Right.
And that's how what I felt the Butler did with this, with America's, again, another part of America's history that we like to forget, the civil rights era, like stuff like that sit-in scene. You saw it, right?
Oh, yeah.
You know, the sit-in scene
where they're
training to do the sit-in and then they actually show it.
Yep.
That was insane.
Yeah.
And brutal. And I don't think I've ever seen that depicted. And hundreds and thousands of young people did things like that. And not even young people, like all kinds of people did that. And that was only 50 years ago.
We talked about it in when we're mentioning best actor, moving on to some of the other trends of this slate of nominees. Matthew McConaughey, holy crap. Somebody pointed out to me on another podcast that he got frustrated with where his career was going. He sat down with his people and said, okay, how do we fix this? And they basically tore up his entire image, which is not easy, especially when you're B-list or A-list or whatever McConaughey happened to be at the time, and said, let's start over and let's try a little harder. And my God, what a role he has got on with the parts that he's been taking, with the directors he's been working with, and with the challenges he's been putting himself through.
The thing about his, like, the stuff he got stuck in with the rom-coms and everything.
Yep.
As a connoisseur of rom-coms, I actually think he gives some really interesting performances in the rom-coms. Like, you can tell he's a really great actor, and given even better material, he would be so good. I always liked him, and I'm glad that he's doing these sort of crazy things. Like Killer Joe was one of my favorites last year.
Yeah.
And I actually really wish he had been nominated for Killer Joe, because he was so good in that. And, like, Magic Mike. And I actually haven't seen Mud. I'm told it was really, really good.
Oh,
I don't know why I haven't seen it, because I love Take Shelter, but yeah, somehow
it's glorious. And it's indicative of what he's doing. Even as god awful messy as The Paperboy is, he's really great in it. And as somewhat messy as Magic Mike is, he is absolutely stellar in it. And you and I were talking last year about how we kind of wanted a best supporting actor for McConaughey for Magic Mike, and here it is. And he shows like no signs of slowing up at all, like, besides the fact that, you know, the guy's working in a damn Christopher Nolan movie next year.
Yeah,
you know, he's doing this amazing ass show for HBO. Totally forgot about, like, his barn burner turn in The Wolf of Wall Street.
Oh my God,
he,
right?
Yeah, he shows up.
Like the one scene.
Yes.
And
yeah. But
he's like, oh, you know, it's one of those roles where you're like, I want more, but I'm glad you didn't give us more, because it makes you appreciate how great that one scene was.
Yep. No, it's insane. And like, you know, welcome back to the party, Matthew McConaughey. If he were to take best actor, it's not just for Dallas Buyers Club, although he is amazing in that movie. Like, he's, you know, he's stealing from the Christian Bale drop a whole lot of weight, you know, school of acting.
Yeah.
But it wouldn't just be for Dallas Buyers Club. It would just be for this just fantastic turn his career has taken, that I sincerely hope is not anywhere near its end. Another trend is, if you're betting on Oscar nominations, and if you're specifically betting on best directing nominations, don't ever bet against David O. Russell anytime soon.
I really love I Heart Huckabees.
Yeah.
Like, all-time favorite.
Yeah.
I Heart Huckabees. And I was all right with The Fighter. Like, I enjoyed The Fighter.
Okay.
My mom really loved that movie, actually, but we saw it together. But his last two movies, I hated Silver Linings Playbook. I hated it. And so many people recommended it to me, and I was just like, don't even.
No, I would have been one of those people because I love that movie.
I'm just like, ugh.
That's fine. That's fine.
I don't know.
But like, here's the funny thing. Here's a guy, like, he couldn't buy employment 4 years ago. You know, he had gotten this reputation as an absolute pissant to work with. He couldn't get his films made. He took The Fighter as, like, you know, a paycheck, basically. And all of a sudden, not only is he on a McConaughey-esque role with three films in a row doing gangbusters, not just for himself, but in Best Picture contention and the actors within it, but holy shit, he went and became the first director ever to get his four leading actors all nominated for Oscars, and he did it twice in a row.
Yeah.
He's the first director to ever do it twice, and he did it in back-to-back years. And he is in some, like there have been a handful of directors who have done it, and it reads like a who's who, you know, like Hal Ashby, Warren Beatty, Ilya Kazan, Billy Wilder, and a few others that I'm forgetting off the top of my head. But the fact that, first of all, that David O. Russell is the only guy to do it twice, and that he did it back to back is amazing. And probably has quite, like, just as much as it has to do with O. Russell and his work, it also has a lot to do with the team over at the Weinsteins, who were smart enough to say, you know what, if we really split this up properly and we don't just start playing vanity roles of who's leading and who's supporting, we'll all win.
Yeah. Because I think it's a nice combination of knowing how to play the game.
Yes.
And choosing, like, his casts are part of, I think, why he's picking the right
actors to work
with. Who are in the right part in their careers to get where they're at.
Yeah. The other thing that I like is that amongst the nominees in acting, especially, nobody is quote due. We've kind of been going through this little stretch for a while where somebody is not as much getting their award on the merit of their performance so much as it is their turn. And I'm thinking specifically of Sandra Bullock and Colin Firth and Jeff Bridges and God, Meryl Streep. We don't have that this year. There's nobody. Well, you know, you can make your case for Leo, but I don't really think he's underline capital letters due amongst the acting. So really what I like about that is we've got a chance for four awards to go on merit.
I think that'll make it more like, it'll be like, what year was that? 2007? Sure. Was that the year Michael Clayton came out?
Yep.
Yeah. That was an interesting year. Cause you know, you didn't really, you kind of thought you knew where things were going. And then Night of, it went all over the place.
Oh yeah. You know. And
starting out with Tilda Swinton, you know, and we're like, holy shit, what are they doing?
Yeah.
And that was one of the last really interesting years where you just, cause like the next year, you know, you just knew everything was going to go Danny Boyle. So the 2007 is one of the last times I remember being like, not like, I remember I had a party that night and I bragged that I was going to beat everybody.
You got schooled, didn't you?
Winners, and I was like, I came like fourth. I came in fourth. Yeah. So that's how interesting a show that was. That, like, I thought I knew what was going to happen, and they were like, nope. And I kind of feel like that's what this year is going to be, where you know, whatever you think is probably not what's going to happen.
Yeah. Well, there we go. That's kind of some of the trends and patterns to these categories. We're going to take one last break, and we'll be right back after this with predictions, very early predictions, and close out the show. So come on back. As we've said in the past, both Mariah and I underline to the nth degree that these are super duper early. It is entirely possible that we are wrong come showtime, and we both reserve the right to change our minds up to and including the day before Oscar night, but right this moment on the wee hours of Saturday, January 18th, 2014. This is what we think.
Hey.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's still the 17th here.
Sorry,
in California.
Sorry, there, West Coast.
We're time traveling right now.
Gotcha.
We're in different
gotcha. Good point.
That's crazy.
All right. So let's start with screenplay. Mariah, who do you have in Best Adapted?
I'm going to go with 12 Years a Slave.
I am going to agree with you. John Ridley, I think he did some really good things and really helped to shape that book. And this is one category where they can really reward it. Best Original Screenplay.
I'm going to go with Spike Jones. I'm just going for it.
I certainly hope so. Original screenplay is usually the kind of category where they like to throw a bone to a movie that can't win in any other category. I'm thinking of something like Charlie Kaufman has won in the past. This is mm-hmm. where Alexander Payne has won in the past. So I'm certainly hopeful that this is the chance they get to reward her. And it's certainly, you know, if you're going by the letter, it's certainly the most original screenplay.
Yeah.
So it's entirely possible that is where it gets rewarded. Best Supporting Actress.
I'm going to go with Lupita.
I want Lupita at this early junction. I think Jennifer Lawrence. Best Supporting Actor.
Oh, man.
Yeah, I know, right?
I'm going to go with Jonah Hill. I'm just going out there.
Okay. All right.
And his teeth.
I am going to put money down on Jared Leto. I think things are going his way right now. Best Actress.
Oh, man.
This is actually the only category where I think it's the closest thing to a sure thing right now.
Yeah, I'm going to go with Kate.
Yeah, me too. You know, and the only thing about that is this is also the category where the sure thing early on gets usurped very late.
Yeah, the only thing I can see is Amy coming in for the surprise, but otherwise I think...
That's true. At least, I was going to say, at least if she does, it's deserving, but that's in my opinion, not yours. Best Actor.
My heart wants to say Chiwetel.
Okay.
I'm going to go with Chiwetel.
Okay. I want Chiwetel. I think it's going to be McConaughey. Best Director.
Duh. I'm going to go with Cuarón.
Okay.
Yeah.
I incorrectly predicted a split with you on a show before, so I'm going to go the opposite and say that they line up this year and that it's Steve McQueen.
Okay.
I think that they'll see, you know, like, don't get me wrong, either one of them, if Alfonso wins, he's the first Mexican director to take the award. If Steve McQueen wins, he's the first director of color to win the award. And either way, it's a good thing. I think it's McQueen, which then leads us to Best Picture. What do you got?
I'm going to go with 12 Years a Slave.
I think so, too. I kind of think it's got the biggest bullseye on it and that it's going to have to really weather some weird stuff in the weeks ahead with the campaign, because this is kind of where back talk and smear tactics and that kind of thing take over. Mm-hmm. So I think it's to lose. But right now, I think it has enough momentum going forward. So there we go. Those are our very, very early choices, and they could entirely change in 6 weeks. But you know, right now, when in the time travel vortex that we're in, that's what we think is going to is going to take it. And that, dear friends, as you might be able to hear by my hoarse voice, is episode 104 of the Matinee Cast. Come on back on Monday, February 3rd. For episode 105, there's nothing new coming out in between then and now that I want to talk about. So we're going to be going back a little bit and discussing August Osage County. Mariah, you can be found all over the place on the internet. So tell people where they can find your works and thoughts and writings.
Well, cinemafanatic.com is where I do the writing and the movie quote of the day. But pretty much any social channel that you can go to, / Old Film Slicker is me. So Twitter, the Facebook.
Yep. And for the love of God, people, she does not only cover old films.
Yes. Old Film Slicker, the Tumblr, is not a description of what I post. It is actually, I got this handle from a song lyric.
There you go.
That I thought was really pretty about watching movies.
Yep.
And it has nothing to do with old films, although there are a lot of old films.
There are. My site is thematinee.ca for more audio content. You can find back episodes by going to thematinee.ca/podcasting. You can also find them using Stitcher Radio, Blueberry, Apple's podcast app, and the iTunes store. Everything gives you ways to subscribe for free and get alerts when new episodes drop. Feedback on any of this Oscar conversation, where we are correct and where we are completely out of our minds, can be left in the comments section of the site. You can also email ryan@thematinee.ca, Facebook, which is facebook.com/darkmatinee, or Twitter, of course, where I am matinee_ca. Mariah, any final thoughts before I let you go for another year?
Go see movies in theaters. I think I said that at the end of last year also.
You should make it your mantra.
You know, I watched a lot of these movies as screeners this year because I didn't have time.
It's not the same.
To go see them in theaters, and it's really not the same. And some of my, like, best memories of films were because I saw them in theaters.
All right, well, for Mariah, I'm Ryan. We'll see you at the matinee and on Oscar night.